Good morning, everyone, and thank you very much for coming today. My name is Kathleen Newland. I'm a co-founder and director of the Migration Policy Institute. And we are very pleased this morning to have the opportunity to collaborate with the International Rescue Committee in launching a report on the humanitarian crisis in Syria. The report, I think, has been distributed to all of you. It's called Syria, a Regional Crisis. And it's the product of a recent visit to the region by the International Rescue Committee, which sent a delegation, including two of our speakers, Morten Abramovitz, who is a member of the board of the IRC Overseers, Sir John Holmes, who's the co-chair of the IRC UK Board of Trustees, Sarah O'Hagan, the co-chair of the IRC Board of Directors, and George Rupp, one of our speakers this morning, who's the president and CEO of IRC. And I was also a member of that delegation, along with several staff members of the IRC, and I believe that many of them are in the room. Sharon Waxman, Alexandra Brosnan, and Melissa Winkler were all with us on that trip. We had the opportunity among the members of that group and the staff to visit all the surrounding countries, Turkey, Jordan, Iraq, and Lebanon. And the report is the result of our observations there, and of course many of you are familiar with the dreadful situation that is unfolding in Syria and seems to be getting worse by the moment. We're also very pleased to have with us today Dr. Fatih Al-Khankan, who is the director of the Humanitarian Committee of the Syrian Expatriates Organization. And Dr. Al-Khankan has very recently returned from Syria and has has been working with the medical community there, and the Syrian Expatriates Organization has been a stalwart source of support, supplies, financing, and solidarity with those brave doctors who are continuing to supply medical treatment in the midst of the ongoing war. Our panel this morning, we're going to start with George Rupp, who, as I said, is the president and CEO of the International Rescue Committee. He's the former president of Columbia University, Rice University, dean of the Harvard Divinity School, et cetera, et cetera. I know George is in favor of brief introductions, so I won't go further with his distinguished background. He will be followed by Dr. Al-Khankan, and finally, Mort Abramovitz, who was my first boss when I returned to Washington in 1992. He was then the president of the Carnegie Endowment, and in those early years when I was there, was in the process of setting up the International Crisis Group with a group of colleagues and was acting president of that in its early years. And Mort is now a senior fellow at the Century Foundation, where he is involved in more track two diplomacy efforts than he or I are allowed to talk about, I believe. So I'd like to welcome and thank all our speakers, and we will allow lots of time for your observations and comments and questions. I know many of you have experience in the region. Probably some of you have also been in Syria or on the Syrian borders recently. So George, let me turn it over to you, and thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you all for coming for what we hope will be a productive and interactive session. In a sentence, Syria's civil war has produced a humanitarian disaster that threatens stability across the Middle East. The numbers tell the story. By early this year, this month, in January, the number of refugees in already overburdened neighboring countries has reached the number 600,000. 3,000 more are crossing those international borders every day, which means that in a matter of months, the projection is we'll have as many as 1 million refugees. There are also over 2 million displaced people inside Syria, and as many as 4 million who are in really quite desperate circumstances, especially now that the winter has hit. Refugees inside Syria, I read that refugees we talked to on outside Syria gave us reports about the situation inside, and the reports were gruesome killings and targeted attacks, arbitrary arrests and torture, abductions and disappearances of loved ones, horrific sexual violence, and unrelenting bombings of homes, schools, hospitals. In fact, targeted bombing of hospitals in particular. When they arrive in neighboring countries, Syrians face overwhelming problems. While some live in camps in circumstances that we have come to think of as the places where refugees live, the vast majority are what we call urban refugees. That is to say, they're scattered through villages and towns and cities, overlooked and often in even much worse circumstances. Again, the numbers are significant. Of the refugees in Lebanon, 100% of them are not in camps. Of the refugees in Jordan, the Syrian refugees in Jordan, 80% are not in camps. The same is true of the Iraqi refugees who fled to Jordan. In Iraq itself, where as refugees have crossed that border, it's about 50% are not in camps. It's only in Turkey, which has made an enormous investment in refugee camps so that it could be an appropriate host to these guests. But even in Turkey, it's only 70% that are in camps, and the remaining 30% are scattered in with the other population. Needless to say, often in the poorest, among the poorest of the population, because that's where they can find cramped quarters or they can find abandoned buildings, and that means that there's a tremendous overburdening of the services, especially in education and healthcare. Those of us who read our home newspaper, the IRC's home newspaper, the New York Times, will know there was a big story yesterday about the Zaatari camp. And it gave a gruesome account of the situation in that camp. It's a camp in Jordan. And yet, in the course of the article, also acknowledged that almost five times as many refugees are outside of camps as in camps, and they are often in even worse circumstances. So the situation is very serious across the region, both inside Syria and also in the neighboring countries, Lebanon, Turkey, Iraq, and Jordan. As you will know when you read our report, we feel strongly that the international community with decisive leadership from the United States must take three urgent actions to address the human needs and mitigate regional tensions. First, the international community must prepare for a large-scale multi-year displacement, and a protracted disaster, not a quick solution emergency, a protracted disaster both inside Syria and across the region. Even when the Assad government is no longer in power, Syrians who have fled may not be able to return home quickly. Recovery and reconciliation needs will be enormous, particularly if it proves difficult to form a stable government, which it almost certainly will prove difficult to form. The civic and social fabric of the country is in shreds, and its economic foundations are devastated. Destruction to infrastructure in cities like Aleppo is 50%. So think of the photographs you saw of Port-au-Prince, Haiti after the earthquake. That's what the second largest city in Syria looks like. Syrian refugees told us they plan to go home when they can, but in all likelihood they will have no homes or communities to which to return for some time. Second, In addition to preparing for long-term instability and an extended period of recovery, the international community must provide much more help right now to neighboring countries as well as to Syria itself. The neighboring countries have opened their borders to refugees and are shouldering more than their fair share of the burden. The refugee influx is straining limited resources, particularly in Jordan and Lebanon, and the welcome mat is wearing thin. In response, international donors and institutions should significantly ramp up bilateral aid to these countries, and thereby encourage neighboring countries to keep their borders open so that innocent civilians will not be trapped inside Syria. And third, donor governments must recognize the severity of the immediate crisis inside Syria, and must do so in particular when the United Nations Secretary General hosts an international donors conference later this month in Kuwait. Current assistance levels are woefully inadequate. Millions are struggling to survive in violence-wracked areas of Syria and have little, if any, access to humanitarian assistance. Dozens of respected Syrian organizations are working on the front line to deliver critical medical care and shelter, to keep schools open, provide clean water, deliver food, winterization items, and other supplies. Channeling assistance to such groups is essential. In addressing these needs for urgent humanitarian action, we must focus in particular on the most vulnerable. In our experience in refugee crises and displaced persons crises around the world, the most vulnerable always include children who are traumatized by witnessing the killing of family members and who in any case have been outside of schools, have had no education for most of the last 2 years. And along with children, women and girls who are brutally raped in part because of the dishonor that brings to their whole families, and who then, survivors told us when we talked with them in Jordan and in Turkey and in Lebanon, and then they have to fear retribution from their assailants. They have to fear being killed by family members who deem themselves shamed. Or for young girls, they have to fear being married off at an early age to protect their honor. So children and women and girls need special attention in this kind of humanitarian crisis. I will close with a further especially horrific feature of this calamity, one that is striking in part because it's, in my experience, quite unusual. In Gaziantep, Turkey, we met with a group of refugees, including a number of medical doctors, who spoke of health professionals who were targeted for killing because they did precisely what their profession requires them to do, namely provide medical care. One of the members of this panel gave us the estimate that of the roughly 5,000 doctors who had been in Aleppo, the city that is now more than half destroyed, of the 5,000 doctors who had been in Aleppo before the crisis, only 36 remained. The rest had been murdered or had fled, including our informant who had kept in touch with former colleagues. He also gave us the sketch that you'll see makes up the cover of our report. It's a sketch that he presented to me at the end of our session with him. And the sketch was the work of a child in the school that the doctor and his colleagues had set up for refugee children from Syria in Gaziantep, Turkey. We are very fortunate to have with us today, as Kathleen mentioned, Dr. Fadi Al-Kankan. As Kathleen indicated, he is chair of the Humanitarian Aid Commission of the Syrian Expatriates Organization. He will tell us about the work that he and his colleagues are doing inside Syria to address both the medical needs and the other challenges there. Dr.
Fry. We're very, very pleased to have you with us. Thank you again for joining us. Dr. Al-Khankan is a pulmonologist. He's originally from the city of Homs in Syria, which you may recognize as one of the cradles of the revolution, and is currently based at Morehouse University in Huntington, West Virginia, as an assistant professor and a faculty senator. So thank you so much for coming all the way to Washington to join us, and we look forward to your report.
Thank you very much for having me here today. I don't know how to start, really. I will try in 10 to 15 minutes. It's very hard to describe what's going on in Syria. It's devastating by all means. But before I talk about our work and what's going on, I want to summarize in 2-3 minutes about what happened there. I mean, of course, we all know the uprising started back in March 2011. That led to a react from the government's forces to react severely on the Syrian people. I mean, what we saw as Syrians, I mean, we look at the neighborhood Arab countries and how did they get their dignity, their freedom back. We saw how the international committees helped them. We thought there is a hope for us to be able to really have our freedom back. Unfortunately, it was not up to the scale what we expected by all means of international aids, from humanitarian to medical, to intervenes and to the UN, talk about what's going on in Syria. So most of people describe what's going on in Syria as a civil war, or a non-international armed conflict. This may be not 100% true, as what's going on in Syria is, if you look at the humanitarian law that says soldiers who honestly combat are entitled to respect. Wounded and sick must be cared for. Civilians under the authority of the fighting parties should be respected, and to respect their lives, dignity, and personal rights. Parties of conflicts at all times should distinguish between the civilian populations and combatants. It's prohibited to employ weapons or method of warfare nature to cause unnecessarily losses. No one must be subject to a physical or mental torture, punishment, or cruel, degrading treatments. If you look at what we have in Syria inside, all these laws has been broken, and broken by one party, especially if we look at the civil war and two parties that are fighting, we can see all these laws were broken by one party. So maybe a civil war or two parties that's fighting, that's not true. 671 days of suffering, torturing, killing, shelling, children has been killed, women has been raped. I can describe it, it's a capital punishment. What's going on in Syria is a capital punishment to the Syrian people. Overall, more than, you said, 2 million of people, they have been displaced. But remember, those people has been lost beloved one, lost their businesses, their houses, their way of living, and their hope. So we're looking at really a big crisis. It's a devastating. I went inside Syria, came 2 weeks ago. What I want to look inside Syria, we can see, I want to describe what's going on in two zones. There is a black zone and a red zone. To look at the black zone are the portion of the country that's under the authority of what's called the regime. Basically, they are under the authority of a gang control. Gangs are controlling the cities. These people is under checkpoints, and every street has been going through humiliation, disrespect, mistreatments. At these checkpoints, get arrested, feel executions, and specially targeting the key member in that societies, like doctors, people who is the most respected in that societies. These people are also has been kidnapped for a ransom or for an exchange of higher officers from the regime, and it's basically a big prison. These people also lost their businesses. They are really under siege. These people mainly can find their food and daily life requirements. They buy from the neighborhood pro-regime areas. Of course, with a much, much higher prices, and that has served as a good income for the regime to continue what's going on now. This formed a network of gangs in these black zones. If we look at the other zones in Syria, inside Syria, I can call it, it's a red zones. In those areas, these are what, it's not under control of the regime. Under control, most of these areas under control of Free Syrian armies. In those areas, these most of people who moved away, refugees camps inside Syria, outside Syria, and displaced because they left their houses. What's going on? They have been getting shelled by all weapons. Randomly, jets has been throwing a dynamite barrels on those people. Randomly. A whole building has been destroyed. Of course, some families still there under siege, and these areas are very hard to go inside and help them.
If you look inside about the situation, what's going on inside, and how we help, we can help them. The regime has been there for 40 years. There is no non-government organization can work inside Syria. What we are doing in SEO, we are a group of first generation. We came here, like for me, I came here from 2002. We felt in the beginning that we're looking at freedom. We want to support the revolution. Then it turned out that a lot of people looking for bread. It turned, the regime was able, unfortunately, to change it, to make people looking for a daily life requirement of food, daily life of medicine. So we start to help our people. SEO is a unique organization because we are a first generation. We can speak their language. We know their culture, and we can help. We are from different areas in Syria, and we have been done many projects. For example, now we are doing the winter project, and we assigned one of our members for each city in Syria. I'm from Homs. If you tell me any street, I know what's going on there. I know the names exactly. Just from the name, I know which family is that. And we started to work. We try to help inside Syria mainly. 12 areas inside Syria with the 12 members of SEO has been working now for one of our projects is the winter project to provide all means for the winters, from blankets to diesel for heating. And shelters for families. The situation is really devastating. We're looking at a long-term crisis in Syria. Even by the unseat of Bashar Assad, the situation is not going to end, but we expect the sooner he goes down, the sooner and the less killing will be. Even as we expect people lost their houses, their businesses. We need to bring them back. We need to help them. And the sooner he can be unseated, the sooner this crisis will at least downscale what's going on, especially the killing on a large scale.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Al-Tantan, and thank you for the work that you are that you and your colleagues are doing to help people in Syria. I'd like to now turn to Morten Abramowitz, who was ambassador in Turkey and provided invaluable connections for our delegation in Turkey and has provided invaluable insights, not not only as a result of his knowledge of Turkey, but of humanitarian situations. When Mort was ambassador in Turkey, he oversaw the Kurdish crisis and responses to it. So Mort has been here before and is going to give us some observations on the larger implications of the conflict. Thank you, Mort.
Thank you, Kathy, for those very nice words.
And could I ask you to speak loudly toward the mic for our...
I am glad to be here.
Thank you.
It's good to see some old colleagues, as well as some of the usual suspects. George Rupp has well laid out basic problems and what needs to be done. I will be unaccustomedly brief and try to just punctuate a few points. Leaving aside the continuing Congo and Sudan atrocities, the two-year Syrian humanitarian disaster, already some 10 to 15% of the Syrian population displaced in some fashion, is the biggest such crisis since the second Iraq war. Ironically, Syria under Assad received the brunt of the Iraqi exodus and did reasonably well in managing that disaster. Three of us on this panel visited Syria to look at the problem in 3 years ago, I think. And Mr. Assad, whom we saw, was playing the world's great humanitarian. Very ironic situation. The Syrian situation is fraught with enormous uncertainty, and short-term response prevails. No one knows when Assad will go away and where. He's clearly not listening to our think tank Cognoscenti, who tell him that he's finished. Doesn't seem to believe it. The unending fighting, of course, produces more internal displacement and refugees. Now, the UN now expects this year Syrian refugees to reach some 1 million people, an increase of 400,000 to 500,000. Millions more are struggling inside for survival, mostly dependent on the help of outside support delivered by courageous Syrian and a few foreign organizations. Equally dismaying to me is that even if Assad hopefully goes soon, the humanitarian crisis may well continue, perhaps even get worse. There is genuine fear of vastly increased sectarian violence. One also has to ask how Syria will be able to function as a state with the government apparatus so broken, the economic foundation devastated, and many of its best people going or gone. That is why a negotiated settlement would have been so useful, but that is clearly not in the cards. We may well see few refugees going home, while many non-Muslims seek asylum, but with a greater possibility of doors closed to more refugees in neighboring countries. Given the uncertainties, we must, as George said, we must think in terms of a larger political and humanitarian emergency of uncertain duration requiring multi-year, large-scale assistance in Syria and to refugees in neighboring countries. Such an undertaking obviously will not be easy for the world to plan and even harder to carry out. Nor does such planning deal with the huge financial requirements of reconstruction. Also needed will be an act of diplomacy to keep the borders of neighboring countries open and funding to back up the countries like in Jordan, where its resources are being severely strained. The Syrian war is also politically corrosive on the stability of neighboring countries. Jordan is in great domestic trouble, and Lebanon is not far behind. Which brings us to the problem of money. So far, the international humanitarian response has been lagging. That is a euphemism. Our current assistance levels are woefully inadequate, as George Rupp said. Where is the UN going to get the more than $1 billion it recently said is needed, and that is just for the next 6 months? Even previous, far lesser levels have fallen short. You think that the United States, which has rightly or wrongly avoided involvement in the Syrian war and left it to Saudi Arabia and Qatar to help the resistance, would at least take the lead in providing humanitarian aid. While America's humanitarian aid is important and larger than any other country, high-level effort has not been noticeable. Proselytizing other countries has been mostly absent, and the 200 million we have provided so far is not very impressive. I may be ill-informed, but I doubt it. The U.S. has an immediate opportunity to better help. The London Pledging Conference in Kuwait, calling for and presided over by Ban Ki-moon at the end of this month. Hopefully, the administration can find some ways to scrounge out some significant funds, or at least indicate it's going to Congress for a special appropriation. That would also facilitate an essential accompanying American effort to get other governments to pony up more funds at the pledging contest, particularly the Gulf's Arab states, who are quick to provide a continuous flow of arms to the opposition to Assad. Hopefully, we will see our new Secretary of State lead the delegation, or some other highly distinguished American like Bill Clinton, and that this effort will mark the beginning of a sustained high-level American effort here and abroad to better help relieve Syrians and the frontline states. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mort, and thanks to all of our panelists for raising a really daunting and widespread array of issues. As Dr. Al-Khan Khan said, it really is difficult to know where to begin to address this crisis, but it is clear that much more help is needed. Two of the things our delegation observed have been mentioned. One, the deliberate targeting of the medical community hospitals, except for those in the regime areas, have either been bombed or simply closed. Doctors have been targeted. And in some of Dr. Al-Khan Khan's initial remarks, it reminded me that it almost seemed as if the Assad regime had a sort of war crimes playbook and were sort of ticking them off one by one, you know, which have we not committed yet? Let's get to that one. It really is a quite systematically devastating attack on the civilian population. And one aspect of that in particular that we were very struck with is an issue that is a feature of modern war. It is always horrific, but it is a particularly sensitive issue in this region, and that is the deliberate employment of sexual violence as a weapon of war, as a means of not only direct attack, but undermining the morale of the civilian population. And we're fortunate that Alina Potts was able to join us this morning. She is the International Rescue Committee's gender-based violence specialist. And I thought we might open the discussion here with asking if I could ask you, Alina, to just tell us a little bit about how humanitarian organizations and the refugee communities and communities inside Syria are coping with this.
Sure. As was shared by the panel, sexual violence is definitely a feature of this conflict. I wanted to take the opportunity to share a few stories with you just to really bring that home. We heard many stories, so I can't share all of them. But, you know, one were from a group of women that told us about five women who were kidnapped from their village, raped, tortured, killed, and then thrown in the streets, you know, as a very clear sign of what would happen to others. And other women have talked about being raped in front of family members. Rape is always incredibly stigmatizing to report and to talk about. You can imagine the additional stigma and shame that comes in a society where, especially if you're raped when you're not married, it may ruin the rest of your life. And the thing that we've seen so far in the region is that, you know, it doesn't stop there. So people cross a border to seek refuge, to seek assistance. 75% of the refugees are women and children. And what they find instead, especially in environments where many of them are going into towns and villages and cities, are that they need a place to stay. They need fuel, they need blankets, they need medicine, they need food. And if that isn't available, they may be exploited. They may have to trade sex for food. People may marry off their daughters because they think it's, you know, a better option for the daughters. I don't think any parent in this room can imagine having to make that choice. And it's an extremely, as the report says, a bleak winter. These are choices that no one should have to make. And I think as the aid community, you know, we have made improvements in the last few months, but in recognizing sexual violence and recognizing the violence that continues, whether it's domestic violence caused by living in difficult situations, whether it's exploitation. But the actual services are still very thin on the ground. And so I think, you know, we really can't expect women to come forward and ask for support when there are no services, or when at a clinic they're taken from person to person to person. This is the woman that was raped. You know, what can we do for her? So, you know, getting those services on the ground is extremely important. In every emergency, they really should be there from the get-go, because if we already have women living alone on the outskirts of a refugee camp, if we already have women who don't know where they can get shelter and so enter into arrangements to get it with unscrupulous landlords, you know, we can do something to help them heal from what they've already experienced, but we're too late to prevent those acts from happening to them. But there are other women and girls that we can do more for. And so I think while we have lost some time here, there's still a lot that we can do and that we're really trying to do in a lot of the region. And so really thank you for your attention today. And I'm happy to answer any other questions if there are questions later about women and girls in the region or about Lebanon in particular.
Thank you very much. I should have said that Alina has just returned from 3 months in Lebanon, where she was working very directly on these issues. And I'd just like to point out that two other members of our delegation who flew down from New York this morning have arrived. Sarah O'Hagan and George Biddle are here with us and can also help us to answer questions about the report. So I know that many of you have experience and observations from the region. We would welcome those and also welcome your questions. Bill. Please introduce yourself and your organization.
Bill Fradlich from Human Rights Watch. I appreciated in the report your caution about safe zones, buffer zones, and I wanted to ask what the prospects are for that. What are the murmurings or more that you've heard in your discussions with the Turkish authorities, for example, with the Jordanian authorities as well, about the prospects of establishing safe zones on the Syrian side of the international borders?
Well, I detected no interest in Turkey in setting up such zones for a variety of reasons, essentially their military concerns. On the other hand, in a sense, along the border in Turkey, there are sizable numbers of Syrian potential refugees who have not been able to enter Turkey. Turks allow them in on a sort of staged basis. That's a small de facto protected zone, but it's not really what we're thinking of as a substantially large area, militarily protected and secure, as we had in northern Iraq, right after the end of the first Gulf War.
We expressed in the report our reservations about all such strategies because in the end they've very rarely worked. It makes an implicit or tacit military commitment that isn't followed through on. I don't have to mention Srebrenica to take really the most garish example, but there are many others as well. That said, Mort rightly points out that de facto there are zones on the border of between Syria and Turkey on the Syrian side that are, if there are no explicit guarantees, nonetheless are taken to be safer than the areas from which those refugees fled. And that's in many ways the worst of all worlds. I mean, there's no assurance whatsoever of security, and yet the situation from which refugees are fleeing is so devastated that they take the gamble that over time they will be able to get through the border and into Turkey. We've tried to be clear about the fact that Jordan in particular, but also Lebanon and Turkey and Iraq, have been enormously generous in welcoming refugees and using their own resources in order to help them. In the case of Jordan, this is now having done first for Iraqi refugees and now for Syrian refugees. And it really is past time for the international community to make more resources available so that whole burden doesn't continue to fall on very small countries that already have huge problems with ethnic diversity within the countries themselves.
Dr. Alkankan, you mentioned the sort of red zones that are not under regime control. How safe are they?
I listened to your question about making safe zones, but most of the casualties happens in Syria, and in the red zones, most of it are by jet fighters. So I think to reduce the casualties and the unnecessary loss, to reduce the people from running away, fleeing those red zones, is by making no-fly zones over Syria. By stopping the flights and the jets from dropping all those dynamite barrels in the red zones and on the borders, this will be the best to reduce casualties. There will be no safe zone. I mean, Syrian regime has been even pumping inside Turkish or Jordanian borders, and there has been many, many incidents of that. It's going to be very hard to put no safe zones without a no-fly zone over Syria. That's the best.
İlhan Tanış from Turkish Press. My question mainly to Ambassador Abramovic, but if anyone wants to. Two quick policy questions, sir. The first one, recently U.S. labeled Jabhat al-Nusra as terrorist organization. Recently, U.S. government labeled Jabhat al-Nusra as a terrorist organization. It looks like it bolstered its popularity on the ground. How would you judge that decision? And the second quick one is, considering everything happened over the 2 years, if you were to be at the White House right now, what would you recommend going forward?
I'm sorry. I'm really having trouble understanding what you are saying.
The organization that was labeled a terrorist organization by the U.S. government, could you explain a bit more?
PKK?
Jabhat al-Nusra.
Also, he wants to know your opinion of that designation and its impact, and also...
In view of particularly the fact that it made them more rather than less popular.
And then what would you do if you were president over the last 2 years?
Well, I don't know the basis, quite frankly, for which the U.S. government labeled it a terrorist organization. I don't know enough about the organization, but I do believe that they would not have done so without significant concern about their activities. On the other hand, of course, they are reported to be a very effective organization and effective in their fighting. So in the short term, it's a question of the short term and the longer term. The short term, they seem to be not facilitating the battle against Assad, but in the long term, they may be reducing ultimately the level of sectarian violence. In the broader question, I simply do not see any likelihood of the United States intervening in any militant way. Maybe the violence will become so great, the atrocities so enormous, that the administration might change its perspective. But at this time, I don't see anything in the cards for a serious American military involvement in the war. Am I answering your question?
Yes.
Thank you.
Hello, Sarah Wilcox from the Scholar Rescue Fund. We work with academics who are being persecuted in their home countries, as George Rupp knows by sitting on our committee. And we're working with a number of scholars who are stuck in Turkey without their passports, without their travel documents. And we're wondering if there's any organization or any mechanism to help them get travel documentation, at least to find safe haven in another country, because they're sitting in these urban regions with no support in Turkey. And a second question is, are there any resources to reunite families who may be divided by the conflict?
I'm sorry, having trouble hearing my question.
Sarah, I will restate the question since I'm right next to Morton. He'll understand it better, because to be honest, I don't know the answer to the first question, the travel documents question. The Scholar Rescue Committee, which is in many ways has overlapping mission with the International Rescue Committee, works with refugees who are scholars, who are educators, and need to get out of a country, and helps to place them in institutions either in the region or outside of the region where they can be effective. And right now, the Scholar Rescue Committee is working with a number of Syrian refugees who are in Turkey but have no travel documents, so they're kind of stuck. And the question is, what... is there an organization, whether the State Department associated with the State Department or anyone else who can help with that kind of situation?
Thank you for explaining the question. I'm not aware of this. My instinct is to believe that if they went to, I don't know what the Turks have for travel documents of this sort, but Turks should be very sympathetic to this effort of getting out a more informed and better statement of the situation in Syria, and would try to help. Now, I don't know where to go. I can't suggest to you where in the agency, but it's clearly seems to me something the Turks might very well be receptive, unless you know something to the contrary that I don't.
Well, in this case, what's really important is that the Scholar Rescue Fund has its own resources and has partnerships with universities, so they're
makes it more likely they don't
sources of support if the right connections can be made.
That doesn't sound right to me that the Turkish government would not find some way to be sympathetic. They would also be getting rid of somebody, to be crudely. So I think that the organization should be very much in touch. You want to ask, are you an American?
Yeah.
Well, you want to get the American ambassador to help you.
I wonder if you've had experience with colleagues who are trying to leave.
It's very hard where there is no way of getting passports. I have, in my personal experience, I know many family members of mine and my colleagues who works with me in the SEO, that they cannot leave Syria. They cannot flee it because they don't have travel documents or passports. I would like the Turkish. I mean, the Turkish, they open their border, they take wounded people, treat them. I mean, it has been very, very helpful for the Syrian people. The solution for that, and that has been suggested, to try to recognize the Syrian National Coalition and try to give them the Syrian embassies in the capitals around the world. And that will really put us really helpful for that. I heard that in Libya, they gave the Syrian embassy and Syrian consular service to the Syrian coalition, and they have been issuing passports for refugees. And that will be so helpful. So far, a lot of countries has recognized the Syrian coalition, the new formed Syrian coalition, but there has been no true process in giving them the Syrian embassies around the world, and so they can issue travel document, passport to the refugees.
Thank you. And on your second question, I think one of the core intentions of the International Rescue Committee is to work with families that have, especially children that have been separated from the rest of the family. So if you have particular cases there, we should be in touch about that.
But as far as I know, there is no systematic thinking about resettlement, even for family reunification purposes. And, of course, even what might have been normal processes for people leaving Syria to rejoin families elsewhere have been disrupted by the conflict. So this is one of the frustrations that I've heard repeatedly from members of the Syrian community here, is that, you know, they're eager, they're willing to look after their relatives, to bring them, to give them shelter, but there's no way to get the travel documents. So it's there may be certainly some cases for use of emergency resettlement procedures, which we all have been talking about for a long, long time.
Well, Sharon Waxman is here and was very much involved with Senator Kennedy when the special immigrant visa category was developed in order to deal with a similar problem of Iraqis who clearly were in danger, who didn't fit the quantitative limits that we had for bringing refugees in. So maybe, Sharon, you could comment on the likelihood of having special immigrant visa, a special immigrant visa program for Syrian refugees.
Yeah, thanks for the question. I think special immigrant visas are a unique category for foreigners who have worked for the American government. So I think in this case, it's probably unlikely. More likely would be that we'd begin a conversation about resettlement, of very vulnerable Syrians through the regular procedures, which I think would be the first step.
Thank you. That we have another question up in the corner here. In the meantime, talking about those especially vulnerable categories and people who have problems with travel documents, one of the things that we observed on the delegation, which we haven't talked about yet, is the extremely difficult situation of both Iraqi refugees who had been in Syria and Palestinians, the Palestinian population of Syria, who have in recent weeks come under particular attack in their communities in the suburbs of Damascus. These are populations that have a sort of double jeopardy and a particular need for protection.
Rachel Levitan with HIAS. I wanted to thank you very much for this excellent report and especially the focus on sexual and gender-based violence, which is very, very useful. The question that I had to do with support for refugees in Turkey, and I understand from the coverage that Turkey has done an excellent job of providing support in camps to the many thousands of refugees that have come over. I also know that over the last number of years it's been very difficult for international organizations to set up operations in Turkey, and that Turkey has very tightly controlled the means by which it provides support to the refugees that it does help and has helped so well. I wondered if you had any indication from your mission as to whether Turkey would be welcoming of more international humanitarian support for the refugees that are there, especially in light of your observation that this is really a protracted this may well turn into a protracted problem, and that the needs of refugees will certainly continue. Thank you.
I've been instructed which parts of this question I should take, and then Ambassador Abramowitz will take the rest of it. Well, first, I think it is the case, and we should stop to recognize it and applaud it, that the government of Turkey has put very substantial resources into trying to provide what they deem to be high-end camps that express their hosting obligation to these guests. And I think it's fair to say that they had not anticipated it would be quite as huge a stretch as it has been. And so in our experience in meeting with senior Turkish officials, they we're much more open to the prospect of having some support and assistance from the outside, including organizations like the IRC. And certainly we're extremely encouraging of assistance that would help to carry some of the burden, even if they bore most of it. So I think there's an openness in Turkey that there wasn't when it seemed as if this was going to be a shorter term, more tractable, smaller scale set of problems. But even if we think of the camps, Turkey's unusual in all of these countries in that 70% of the refugees are in camps. But that means there's still a very substantial number, the other 30%, that are living in really extremely impoverished conditions. And there, too, it will be important that there be assistance provided to the Turkish government to provide more adequate help to those refugees. And then finally, there's the population that Mort Abramowitz called our attention to, namely those who, and this is hard to say because Turkey has been a good host, but there is no question that there are Syrians on the border who are being titrated into Turkey, not being really escorted happily and welcomingly through open borders. And so there are layers of problems that Turkey is struggling with and I think is more open to having international assistance than was the case earlier.
And having had some experience with Turkey's management of large-scale refugee inflows, particularly in 1989 when there were 500,000 Kurds hanging out on the mountain borders of Turkey. The Turks have done exceedingly well in letting in Syrians and taking care of them. And as you know, if you have some documentation, there's no visa requirements between Turkey and Syria. And so a lot of people, particularly those who have some resources, have drifted into the cities and operate on their own. So, and also Turkey's put up something like $500,000 and it's growing. That's an extraordinary contribution. So from that standpoint, the Prime Minister has truly been, I think, a very humanitarian leaning figure. In terms of operating in the camps of the NGOs, which obviously IRC and many other NGOs would like to do because there are very serious problems within the camps, the Turks have been very, very skeptical and negative. Maybe that's changing. Partially it's a nationalistic reaction that it's our camps, we don't need you guys, we'll manage it. Partially is that the some of the camps were used to provide arms and distribute and let people enter Syria through Turkey. So whether that's continuing, I don't know. I sort of sense, as George said, that the Turks are getting a little more generous in allowing in or cooperating with international NGOs. I think that's the case. Would you agree?
Yeah, well, just to put it concretely, I mean, the IRC is working with the permission of the government in Turkey with Syrian refugees who are instrumental in getting medical and winterization supplies into areas of Syria that desperately need those. And so that's one of the reasons for our trip was to work out that arrangement. And that's clearly known by the Turkish government and recognizes that we have special capacity there. But as Mort notes, they have not yet gotten to the point of feeling completely resolved on the question of whether international staff, whether UNHCR or IRC, wind up in their camps working with refugees.
Yeah, in Turkey they have been very helpful. I think what we are facing, in each country there is a law and there is bureaucracy. So we are not facing an intentions against helping Syrian people as much as we are facing a small, just mild bureaucracy, or we have to follow the Turkish law. I mean, Turkey has been very helpful. I mean, I'm as a doctor, I saw many wounded people has been treated freely without any charges in governmental Turkish hospitals. These are civilians who were wounded in the refugees has been treated. I mean, a lot of Turkish doctors has been treating people there. In schools, Syrian refugees are allowed to go to school, but the problem is there is a language barrier, that Turkish language. It's very hard to understand. So that's all I want to say. Thanks.
Thank you.
Can someone either on the panel
Could you
or,
please introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Amani Azeldin, and I work for the Homeland Security. But in a headquarters component, so I don't know this answer. Can someone on the panel or in the room comment on the U.S. or other government presence in Syria and then in Turkey, Jordan, Lebanon, and Iraq who are working on refugee processing, whether it's happening and to what extent, and I don't know if it's even happening in Syria yet, but in the other countries.
My understanding is that there is no processing for resettlement of Syrian refugees yet. Refugee resettlement has tended to focus on, in recent years, on long duration crises. People have been in camps for many years and so on. There were Iraqi refugees being processed out of Syria. And as I mentioned earlier, those processes have been disrupted. So that has sort of come to a halt now. And I think, you know, the focus at this point, and others in the room who know better, please correct me if I'm wrong, but my impression is that the focus is so much now on trying to deal with the immediate humanitarian crisis and the uncertainty of the duration of the conflict, how quickly people will go back, whether they'll be able to go back, whether there will be, you know, sectarian violence that makes it impossible for some people to go back to their homes. All of these things are still very uncertain, and so I think judgment is being reserved about the nature and the timing of a resettlement process. But if anyone else has information on that, I think we would all welcome it. There was another question in the... Thank you.
My name is Dr. Ghassan Aid, and I have a question and something to just for information. The question is, I heard lately in a lot of media and in the social network that all aids coming to Jordan and Beirut or Lebanon did not arrive to the camps. The only aids arriving to the camps are in Turkey. But in Jordan, that's what I heard in the media and in the press, and it was widely distributed. In Jordan, mainly, all the aid that came from Saudi Arabia or from the Gulf countries did not arrive to the camp. I would like to know what you think about that. And the second issue, everybody is talking about the Syrian revolution as a Islamic revolution or Salafist revolution, or something like that. I would like just to note, when the French went into revolution against the Nazi German in France, they were held 25% by the communists, but their revolution did not be a communist revolution. 25% were communists, but that's not a communist revolution. When America went into a civil war, the French under Lafayette came for America to help. Does it make it a French revolution, French civil war? No. The Salafists in Syria is one group, like 200 other groups, who is trying all of them together, united, to free their country. And this is why. And they represent nothing, 5% maybe. We cannot say that the people in Syria revolting for their freedom and their liberty, we cannot say that this is a Salafist or stuff like that. And the second issue about the lady who was talking about the raping. Worse than raping, the slavery starts again. A lot of people coming to Jordan, buying girls from the camp, going to their parents, offering $50 for something called officially marriage. That's how they do it. They do the slavery under a new term. they do the slavery under a new term, marriage, waiting. And many families, because they are poor and uneducated, they think that getting $50 for a girl, she will have a nice palace to live back to the girl. Unfortunately, she is not a strong slave, and her life will be destroyed. Thank you.
Thank you very much for those comments. I'm sure Dr. Fadi would like to respond to some of them. If I could just on the question of aid not arriving in camps, we had meetings in both Jordan and Turkey with officials from the U.S. and British governments who are providing humanitarian assistance. And I can say from our own direct observation that certainly aid is arriving in camps. We've visited the Zaatari camp in Jordan, and though the conditions are very poor, there is certainly food being provided, shelter being provided, and some services such as education and so on. But I understand the implication of your question, but I think IRC would like to see much of the aid not arriving in camps, because camps are not where the people are, as long as we're confident that it's arriving to refugees, and I understand that was the import of your question. But devising some way to deliver assistance to those people who are not in camps is really one of the number one issues, I think, at this point. But we certainly did see that there is international assistance arriving to the camps and some increasing awareness of the importance of people who are not in camps. On the question of the nature of the revolution
I just want to start by, I don't represent IRC or any organization. From my personal view, I've been to Turkey more than 10 times.
I've been to Jordan 20 times before I come here to the United States. So I'm going to just tell what I saw, what I know. I mean, in Jordan and Lebanon, there is a lot of corruption that I know for a fact. So what's going on I'm representing myself. So what's going on is just taking the money because of the corruption in their humanitarian committees, in their Turkish is much, much less corruption since the new modernized Turkey has started. So that's why they have been more effective in delivering aid to the Syrian people. On the other thing also I want to tell about, like, is it an Islamic or jihadist revolution? I don't think so. I mean, people who started the revolution were not the Islamic groups or Islamic Brotherhood. It started for most of the people who is the modest, well-educated people went in the streets of Damascus and or in Daraa. But what we see most of the YouTubes, we see Allahu Akbar, we see people coming up to the mosque. Guys, if I want to die, I want to pray before I die. I mean, that's for facts. But what will happen is in Syria, as I remember, there is 8 million, 40% of the Syrian people are youth, or what I want to say is students. So imagine there has been no schools for 2 years now. Even if you look at the children who were in the sixth grade or seventh grade, they have been 2 years, they have not attended school. So we're looking at a large scale down the road, less education, people forget reading and writing. So the sooner we end this crisis, the sooner we let the regime go away and open schools back, the less problems we will have in the future.
Sorry, George, did you want to comment on?
Patty McAleady with Interaction. Thank you for the presentation.
And the humanitarian side by side, and I think that's a very good way to look at it because the needs are so great and we each have our roles to play and the first responders as well in terms of the national organizations who are assisting in these countries. I think we have to really reiterate and look at how we can be helping them better. But at the same time, we need to know what they're doing. We need to figure out how are we going to coordinate ourselves better. And there are mechanisms being put in place to try and address that. And my question for the group that visited was,
how well did they see this happening? Was it occurring? I mean, we have gaps. I mean, so we can be looking at how do we get better into Turkey, but really, if the government has it somewhat under control, I'd like us to be looking at what we can be doing in the other areas where there aren't as big a need. I mean, we know the challenges of community hosting of refugees are enormous. It's a huge strain on the government themselves. They don't know where the refugees are necessarily. The community is overstretched in trying to assist them. But at the same time, it's a major strain for UNHCR in terms of how are they themselves assisting the government in doing that. And so what did you feel in terms of the information sharing, the knowledge of what was going on, and also the coordination of the response from that side, from the leadership? As you may know, UNHCR both has their internal country representatives who are supposed to be having a responsibility to help with this, but as well, they have a regional refugee coordinator. And so to look at how we can ensure that the assistance happening in these communities are somewhat replicable, that they're the same, or at least not looking terribly different, that we have populations flows moving from one country to another because it's better over there. So just if you can comment a bit on what you felt that, whether that was happening and what we can do to help improve that. Thank you.
George, would you like to comment on that?
Well, it's a huge, complicated, interlocking set of issues. And I think there are genuine efforts for regional coordination, and there are also within countries efforts of coordination, both by outside agencies and by the government. But the situation is very different in different countries. So I think in the case of Jordan, where there have been now multi-year successive crises, there actually is quite good coordination with the government, with the UN, with international NGOs that are located based in Amman, but located throughout Jordan. It's much more complicated in the case of Turkey because there are very few outside NGOs there. There's been a great deal of uneasiness about the role of the UN. So I think it's just at a much earlier stage of coordination. But I don't think it's the case that there are plenty of resources in Turkey, and so we should make sure we focus instead on Jordan and Lebanon, where there are fewer resources, because I think all of those countries have their capacity being stretched, and it will be, over time, there may well be more coordination, but I don't think any of us could honestly claim there's great coordination now between what is going on in, let's say, in Jordan and in Turkey, because of the very different stages at which they are involved in this whole process. I resisted commenting further on the earlier question about the perception that assistance is going only to camps in Turkey. Now, you did say that was aid coming from Saudi Arabia and other countries, and I think the response to you was that, you know, there's no question that Western assistance has, in our view, disproportionately gone to camps rather than to the non-camp populations. But it may well be that in the case of assistance to camps, Saudi Arabia has decided, for the reasons that Dr. Fadi suggested, that it was better to put the money into Turkey where there is less corruption and all the rest of it. But there is no doubt that the camp-based populations get, if anything, a disproportionate share of the attention and of the resources. And you mentioned Lebanon and Jordan. In the case of Lebanon, there are virtually no camps for refugees. So it has to go to non-camp populations. And in the case of Turkey, in the case of Jordan, it's at least 80% are not camp-based. And so there are great resource needs in the non-camp-based population. Your last comment about the $50 for a daughter, you could not have said it more eloquently. That is a perfect illustration of the kind of enslavement that happens in the kind of predatory sexual situation that refugees are in. When 75% of the people in camps are women and children, they have really no access, no protection, except insofar as organizations like ours provide the kind of protection that we seek to provide, but it makes the young girls are extremely vulnerable in that situation. Any of us who have daughters can't help but think about that.
And it's exactly what we saw with the Iraqi refugees in Syria when IRC had a delegation there 3 years ago, the same issues of early marriage, survival sex, as it's known. One conversation that we did have with the Syrian refugee group in Gaziantep, I found encouraging, at least as a signal that leadership among the Syrian refugee community is aware of this problem and is trying to counteract the burden of shame and dishonor and so on that's associated with sexual violence and that re-victimizes the victims. We were told that some of the fighters of the Free Syrian Army are quite systematically and deliberately marrying rape victims to demonstrate that they understand this as a war wound, that this is a victimization that doesn't carry any more shame than being hit with shrapnel, and that they're trying to make a demonstration of that. I don't know how far they're getting. I don't know how widespread it is, but it was at least encouraging to hear from one group of leaders that there is an awareness that this is a problem that has to be shifted from the shoulders of the victims themselves. Yes, Alan.
Yeah, I'm Alan Jury. I'm U.S. representative of the United Nations World Food Program. We have very extensive programs in Syria and the region, and I think the report has accurately identified the key problems. I mean, I think in terms of the donor response, it's been generous up to this point, but the need is expanding so rapidly. I mean, for more talked about it, for example, in the food area alone with WFP, we need more money in the next 6 months than we've needed in the whole crisis up to this point. I mean, we started in Syria with 200,000 people. We're now reaching 1.5 million, and that's not the entire need because there are capacity constraints that don't allow us to go higher. The refugee populations, has already been said, is just going up rapidly. So one of the real messages to get out is not sort of, I think to sort of say there's a lot of good assistance, particularly from the West. I think the Arab world is a little bit less clear. But even if there has been, the need has expanded so dramatically, we need to be talking of an order of magnitude just much, much bigger than we've been at. The other thing is there are a couple points that I wanted to make regard to some of the earlier questions. We are able to operate in Turkey, and it is true, as everyone's already said on Turkey, they have been slower to have international assistance. But they now have a dialogue with us. We're preparing vouchers in Turkey. We're working in 5 camp areas and have been. And, in fact, our executive director is in Turkey today as part of a visit to the region. Similarly, with regard to the urban refugees, as people point out, the ratio between camps and urban refugees is very different than in many circumstances. And that's why WFP and its programs outside of Syria has gone heavily to voucher programs. 80% of our assistance in the neighboring countries, Jordan, Lebanon, Turkey, Iraq, and now starting in Egypt, is through voucher programs that allow people to redeem coupons in stores rather than more traditional general food distribution. And that has been coordinated on a region-wide basis. Not every country is the same, and the voucher program isn't identical, but it is a reflection of the fact that there are markets, that many of the people aren't in camps, and that by doing food this way, we don't create food programs as an incentive for camps, a population that we can deal with in other ways. And that's represented now probably one of our largest voucher programs. But the overall dimension of this thing is just staggering. And if we continue at the rate that we anticipate for the next 6 months, Syria will be the largest food aid program in the world if it continues at that rate. And from a period that was essentially barely a blip in WFP's programs 15 months ago, a small program for Iraqi refugees, a very small program for some other vulnerable groups in Syria, and now at a rate we're spending at a rate of $260 million every 6 months, and that's at the rate of current estimation of refugee populations. So it's a staggering figure, and it's a staggering challenge to manage. And I think the report underscores that in some of its recommendations on the assistance side.
Thank you very much, Alan. It's really encouraging to hear that there's some creative thinking going on around new ways of delivering assistance. I wanted to ask Dr. Okankan if you could also to comment on some of the sort of medical issues that you're seeing arising from the food deficits, the just the general deprivation inside Syria. That's,
Most of the aid that has been going to the refugees around Syria, but not that many going to the inside of Syria. We went inside, we saw has been a lot of hospitals has been bombed, medical personnel has been arrested, tortured, or fled away. So what we're looking at big medical crisis. We went through inside the northern border of Syria and to the inside to multiple fields hospitals. We saw a lot of lack of equipment. For example, I work with a pulmonary. We went inside many ICUs inside, and there was no ABG machine, which is blood gases to check the blood, the oxygen level in the blood, which is something simple, small portable machine. We use it here in every small hospital we have it. So there is a lot of lack of medical supply and support to the inside of Syria. I think if the humanitarian and the medical aid increase to the inside, that will decrease the scale of people that's fleeing away from Syria through the border, and that will help in at least people who stay inside the border of Syria will feel less humiliated, and they will feel more settling at their home country, so it will be helpful. Inside Syria, we saw a lot of people that's encouraging. I saw doctors who's living inside the hospital, surgeons, living there just by with their salaries, their food, and they're sleeping with the scrubs the whole time. We were really, and in the hospital we saw a lot of stories of most of the, like, from the ICUs, most of the people there is children and women, civilians basically. So we need a lot of help inside Syria.
The program on the programs on this visit that I was most excited about is one that we have actually talked very little about for a variety of reasons, the most important of which is that we cannot endanger our partners in Syria. But the IRC really does have very substantial programs, well-funded by private donors and by governments, for bringing medical supplies in from Jordan, including equipment of exactly the sort you've described, and then winterization supplies in from Turkey into Syria. I think those are absolutely crucial initiatives, and they need to be ramped up further. They're very effective, and we know they get where they're going because we have electronic tags on the equipment, and we can make sure they, in fact, wind up at the clinic or the hospital that was bombed and doesn't have the equipment that's needed. But I wouldn't claim that what we're doing is beginning to address the severity of the problem. And I should say... His organization is not one of our partners, so I don't get anybody in trouble here. We have other partners inside Syria, and we've known and we've identified, and we're very confident, and we have tracked and know that the equipment is getting where it's going. But the fact is that the need is far outstripping the supplies, even though they're substantial, but the supplies that we've been able to get in over the last couple of years.
Okay, I think we have time for just one more question, and I'd like to give our panelists a chance for a last word, if they wish.
Hi, Abby Taylor from Georgetown University. My question is for Dr. Alkhan Khan, more about the medical professionals, the brave medical professionals who are in Syria, but also those Iraqi doctors who are now exiled in neighboring countries. I wonder what... can they work in neighboring countries? Because obviously the work permits do not allow them to, but have you seen efforts from Syrians? I don't know if it's on here. Yeah. From Syrians who are actually managing to work in Jordan or Turkey or Lebanon to help those fellow Syrians. And also, I would say that there was, but to a lesser extent, targeting of medical professionals in Iraq, only to a lesser extent, and it's continuing now. And it was medical students as well, medical universities. I wonder if you could talk more about medical students in Syria who are perhaps having their certificates withdrawn, forced into conscription for military service, if that is also happening. And finally, on mental health for children, I spoke to an Iraqi doctor once who said it's really a time bomb for children in Iraq. And I wonder if anything can be done at the moment in terms of short-term responses to really help those children in terms of mental health in Syria and out West Syria. Thank you.
Thank you. To respond on the first part of in Syrian doctors who flee the country, if you look at the neighborhood countries, there is law. The same as here in the United States, there is a law who can practice medicine. So it's very hard for Syrian doctors, for example. We have to go through examinations. We have to go through requalification to practice medicine. So on the Jordan or Turkish soil, it's very hard for a Syrian doctor to just open a clinic or work there freely without anything. So most of the hospital has been established are inside the borders, inside Syria. This will be most helpful because, number one, it will be less expensive, and it will be operated by Syrian doctors who is really voluntarily working, the same as we did. We went there inside. That will be more helpful. So the aim, if can be targeted to the field hospital inside Syria, will be more helpful. We visited many hospitals inside Syria that was established from really nothing, in an old house or old school that turned to a whole hospital and operated with doctors, by Syrian doctors with no salaries. So if we can aim that help inside, that would be helpful. It's very hard to go through requalification in Turkey and to practice medicine or to get a license. I don't know Turkish language. It's going to be very hard. If I look at the medical students, medical students has there a lot of them has fled away. I mean, the crisis that affected everybody, all schools from elementary to the college. I personally know many students that have been working in the medical field. They were just medical students, first year, second year. They have been helping people. Even I met a non-medical personnel that became very expert in suturing and treating sick people. I was amazed by how these people just learned. I know a dentist that I've been talking to him over Skype, and he is doing surgeries and taking bullets out of the patient's abdomens. We saw these crises. I mean, the need is huge inside. Because of the Syrian doctors has been targeted initially, and the key members of the society has been really the one that has been arrested and feel executed on the checkpoints. We see a lot of lack of Syrian doctors inside few areas, like in Homs, in the old city of Homs, Bab Houd. I know there is a lot of lack of medical supplies and Syrian doctors. So a lot of medical students has stepped up to work as a doctor. Over Skype, I know many Syrian medical students who have been working and treating sick people, a chronic disease like diabetes, hypertension. There is no doctors there, and been having consulting us over Skype to help them. Unfortunately, on the second part of your question about the mental health, I know we don't have a program to help those children. We don't have a program to help those people who went through suffering. We don't. But let me tell you, people have no food. The people have no medicine. People have no shelter, no house to live in. It's very hard to go in and talk to a woman who has been raped sitting in front of the hospital. I mean, just to talk to her about her mental health, it's going to be very hard. Very hard to do that. Mainly, we have to look at the basic life requirements for these people. Like, for example, when I was in a field hospital, I saw a woman was sitting there in front of the hospital, sitting on the wall of the hospital, putting her head on the hospital inside Syria. I asked about her, and she told me her daughter was in the ICU inside. I went to the inside. I saw her daughter. She's 4 years old, has a bullet.
and she has been doing well. I came out and told her, you go home. She told me, this is my home. I lost my husband. I lost my two sons, and this is the only one that I'm living for. And she has been for a month sitting in the front of the hospital, living there, literally, putting her head on the wall and sleeping. She has no shelter, no family. It's going to be very hard to talk about mental health for her without getting her food or getting her house to sleep in first.
Thank you.
Well, I'm afraid we have to wrap up now. I want to thank all our panelists. I just parenthetically, I would add that one of the visits we made was to an IRC-employed psychologist in the north of Jordan who was running a clinic, a very discreet clinic for victims of sexual violence. Of course, you can't put up a sign saying, you know, raped women come here, but doing it, integrating it into maternal and child health programs and so on. So, but the need is huge and very much unmet. We also visited a hospital in Jordan that was being run by Syrian doctors for mostly war wounded and other acute cases in Amman. But again, you know, operating at an insane pace and meeting only a tiny fraction of the need. I want to thank you all for coming. Thank you for your concern for this issue. As you, I'm sure you know, there are other briefings on the situation in Syria around town, one this afternoon at Brookings. I think it's at 3 o'clock. So I think it is incumbent on all of us to not only inform ourselves, but to really ramp up our advocacy efforts for meeting this, the needs of this terrible tragedy that's unfolding in and around Syria. Thank you, Mort. Thank you, George. Thank you, Dr. Salgadi.
For more information on MPI's Refugee Protection Program, please visit www.migrationpolicy.org/research/refugee.php.